College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Nagandi.
Well, the second playoff rankings are out. How about this? Not one team in the top 25 stayed in the same spot. Very fluid situation, which I like. It was fluid last week. It's fluid this week. And coming up, Heather Dinich on which team should be most worried and what conference could be in trouble in the coming weeks. Ivan Maisel also joining us on how Saturday's loss in Tuscaloosa was more than just a loss for Nick Saban in Alabama. Right now, though, let's start with David Pollock. And what is up, my man? The biggest question I have for you is, did we win championships on Sunday?
Two championship games, two dubs, my man.
Oh.
Two dubs. It was a different contest. The first game, I'll tell you what, Artenu, this is the team that we played against last year, that they've lost one game since they were 6 years old, this team we played, and that was us last year beating them. Don't feel sorry, not sorry. And we played them in the championship game, and we got out 18 to nothing, Kevin, in five plays.
Ooh, offensive plays. All the film study was paying off.
We got a 90-yard slot fade, which was absolutely perfection. It was actually 94 yards from our own six. We ran a zone read play up the gut that our QB took off to the house, and then on a fourth and five, we went 4 for 4 on fourth downs. We went fourth and five. We had a 50-yard pass. So got out 18 to nothing and held on. They got it back 18-12 and made some great adjustments to what we did and did a good job. But, in the end, run the clock down. Tenyi runs the clock down. We get the ball 40 seconds left on the 25, fourth and six. And we hit him with Wildcat a couple times. So we hit him with the, Wildcat go. So we stacked everybody on the left side. We had three receivers and two running backs on the left side, you know, got the edge, and we ran the X on the outside receiver blocks for a second, then releases and ran a go, and we chucked it to him and scored a touchdown on last play. So we won by 14, but it was not that good, but it was a dub, baby. It was a dub. So I know this all sounds, you know, over the kill. It's 10 years old. You can say whatever you want, but it's a big deal to us. And in 12U, you know, the average line for the Stonehenge team we played, they averaged about 230 on the offensive line at 12 years old.
Wait a second. This is
30.
I thought this was flag football. This is hitting football?
This is tackle football. Tackle, bro.
Okay.
Seriously?
Okay. Well, I didn't know.
Come on, man.
I didn't know.
No, this is real football.
Okay.
And so they average about 230 on their line. They're enormous. We average about 140, by the way. 130.
All those kids get scholarships to Georgia.
These kids, 12-year-olds. These 12-year-olds are all kids that are going to go play somewhere. I promise you that. But they went down the field first possession they got and just stuck it right down our throat. Literally ran the ball every play right up the middle, and we could do absolutely nothing. So we made a few tweaks. By the way, I got my A-gap defenders to just cut the legs out of the guards and make a pile, and we stopped the dive. That's how we stopped the dive. But we wore them out with tempo and the passing game and getting on the perimeter and some pick routes and some nice touchdowns, and we won that one 20-6. So it was a good Sunday in the Pollock household. The wife was happy, the kids were happy, I was happy. It was a good day, bro.
Who was happiest though, the kids or the coach?
Probably the kids. You know, my son was jacked up. Don't get it twisted. My wife was jacked up too. Now she's competitive.
I love it.
She's super sneaky competitive, but, you know, it was bittersweet, man. Cause I was in tears at the end of the 12U game. Cause when I started coaching these kids, Kevin, 4 years ago, almost five seasons ago, it was the first group I coached, and this was 12U. This is their last year with me. So
that's cool.
It really, it was bittersweet, man, because we had about seven of them that started with us in the beginning that finished with us all the way. And it was, man, they've been a part of the Pollocks for a while, and we've been a part of their lives, and it's been really, really super cool. So now that they say goodbye, and that's sad, but, you know, it was still fun, still cool, and good to go out with a win.
And you know what? Football at that time for them is pure. So they're going to have great memories looking back.
It's awesome.
That's cool.
No doubt.
Good job, Coach Pollock. Good job.
All right. I know Alabama and LSU played some little game, but you know, it wasn't Stonehenge and Titans.
I want to remind everyone as well, if you have a question you want to hear on the podcast, for Herbie or Pollock, just tweet us using the hashtag CFB Pod. and our great producer Taylor will make sure we get that on the air. The best, great producer. The best.
Wow, great.
I'm in a great mood right now. So
I'm about to say, great.
The best questions will make the podcast for Pollock. We've got a couple coming your way later on.
And the worst can pound sand. What do you think about that?
The two questions we have are actually really, really interesting, and I'm glad we're going to bring it up. But my biggest question to you to start here is, did the committee get it right last night?
Sure. You know how I feel about this. There is no right answer right now. Like, there is no right. I am very glad. And the biggest thing I wanted to see was Minnesota needed to make a huge jump, and they jumped 9 spots. And that's exactly what should have happened. If you've been watching Penn State, Penn State's a really good football team. The committee thought a lot of them. They had several quality wins, and now, they get beat by Minnesota. Minnesota has earned the right to move substantially up in the rankings, and they moved all the way up to 8, which is amazing to see that jump. Alabama at 4 or at 5 doesn't bother me. They should be behind Georgia. Georgia has more quality wins. We've talked about that over the years. Utah and Oregon still in great spots, considering no real win of any significance whatsoever. So Minnesota, if you're a Minnesota fan, it doesn't really matter. I would have Minnesota higher than Oregon and Utah, but it doesn't matter because you got Iowa, you got another opportunity. Then you got Wisconsin, another opportunity. Then you'll have the Big 12 or Big 10 championship game to prove it again. So the rankings really, at this point, it doesn't matter that much because it's all going to take care of itself. But I was happy to see those things.
I'm with you. Minnesota made the big jump, as they should. I would have had them 6th.
I would too.
Over the two Pac-12 teams. And is there a team out there that you saw that you think should be really worried or concerned?
Yeah, if I'm the Big 12, I'm really concerned. You can't say they're eliminated, Kevin, but they're in a really bad spot.
Especially Baylor dropping one spot, right?
And here's the thing. And here's the just being completely honest with our people, because that's what we do with our people. We're honest with them. If I'm watching Baylor and Minnesota, first of all, there is reason to look at Baylor or Minnesota earlier in the year and to dock them and to say they don't – last week to say that they don't belong near the top 10. I'm okay with that because when you saw them early in the year when they played the Jackrabbits of San Diego State and it was 28-21, and remember they played Fresno and Georgia's, all those games were fourth quarter games where they won by a touchdown, a field goal. Like they did not look great. Since that point and since they beat Purdue, if you look at the month of October, they were killing people, destroying people. And you could tell they got their groove, winning by an average of almost 40 points groove, 35 plus points all these games. And now you go beat Penn State. That's a team that, to me, that is ascending and taking off and has found out, and Tanner Morgan's got his niche and they got their niche, and defensively they figured out who they are. I don't feel the same way about Baylor. Now listen, if you're a Baylor fan, who cares? You're still winning and you're still taking care of business. But I'm thinking about Baylor and TCU this past week in triple overtime, and it was 29-23. I'm thinking about, 17-14 against West Virginia, which was ugly. And then I'm thinking about the game before Oklahoma State where it was 33-30 and 2 OTs versus Texas Tech. Like, they're not playing great football. They're finding a way to win, but they're playing average. So to me, I think Minnesota deserves to be ranked significantly higher than Baylor. And I don't see Baylor as a team that should be ahead of Auburn, as a team that should be ahead of Florida, as a team that should be ahead of Penn State and those teams.
I'm with you. And one good thing we're going to get is they're going to settle on the field, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's the one thing I'm most looking forward to on Saturday. Matt Rhule is the underdog at home. With Jalen Hurts, and then we can figure out Oklahoma's defense. Are they the 2019 version or the one that we've seen the last couple of weeks where you're like, oh gosh, they've taken 30 steps backwards and they look like they're 2018 all over again? Because I'm watching that game the other night against Iowa State, and Iowa State's pretty, their record doesn't dictate how I think about them. I think they're pretty good.
And I agree. I think they're pretty good team.
And you're sitting there and you're like, all right, they got this in control. CD Lamb, 97-yard drive. They look good. They're going to be winning this game. The next thing you know, you're like, how is this a 1-point game? Like, what just happened? And again, it's Oklahoma's defense, and they've got a ton of questions, and the committee's not impressed. You've been in the tape room. Do you want to talk LSU Alabama now, or do you want to talk about a specific unit that turned your heads when you watched the tape? Or is that even just blended into Alabama LSU?
I will talk whatever you want me to talk. But I was blown away by a couple different units, and we could discuss later. But like Minnesota's offense, I was blown away with. But if you want to talk about LSU's offense real quick, it's just unbelievable. First of all, the play calling was awesome. You know, and they did some things, and they set up routes early in the game and came back to them, a la 5 minutes left in the game when they ran the quarterback draw RPO, which was just amazing. It was unbelievable. I'm like, what an unbelievable play call. But to me, it was an unbelievable job of knowing your personnel, of knowing Joe Burrow, of making big plays early in the game. But more importantly, it had a lot to do with just Joe Burrow. Like, we give Joe Brady a ton of credit, Kevin, and he deserves a ton of credit. Joe Burrow made big play after big play after big play after shrugging off Terrell Lewis, after shrugging off Jennings, after shrugging off a blitzing linebacker. Like, he literally made so many of these plays by himself that were not scripted. They were not Joe Brady. They were not Jefferson or Chase or any of those guys. And that was the biggest takeaway about their offense. They did a lot of things at will. And Clyde Edwards-Helaire, by the way, good God. You know who he is to me? You know who he reminds me of? Maurice Jones-Drew.
Nice.
Little bowling ball, you know, 5'9", built thick, great catching the ball out of the backfield, makes people miss. The third down and 10 play he had on the sideline with 11 minutes left when Alabama had all the momentum.
Pure will.
It was absolutely pure will, but watch how he sets up his block and what he did there. Not his block. Watch how he set up his run. He pauses before the sideline. So you can't hit a guy out of bounds, right? You can't hit him on the sidelines because it's a 15-yard penalty, but they're not going to let you cut up and make yardage. He pauses for a second like he's going to cut up, gets the defender to really relax and get on his heels, and then runs straight at him. Went straight at Diggs and literally runs through him and carries him 6 yards for a first down. They go down, they score and put more pressure on Alabama. It was awesome to see, but Joe Brady obviously has done an amazing job with the offense, but man, it was the first time that I saw where Joe Burrow did a lot by himself and a lot off schedule and on his own. Every time something broke down, it was okay because Joe was cool and he was making plays and he won the Heisman Trophy last weekend.
Yeah, that was his game. He's that guy. And yeah. Edwards-Helaire, so tough, man, on a couple of those plays where you're like, we're going to answer back regardless of how many big plays Tua is going to make. We are going to answer regardless. And I'm not taking anything away from Burrow. Brady, LSU's offense, Edwards-Helaire. There was some things, though, that Alabama defensively that stood out where I was like, ooh, what's going on here? And is this because of injuries and inexperience? What did you see from the Bama defense?
You know, it's very interesting because Alabama, we've talked about the inside linebackers this year, right?
Yeah.
We've talked about Lee and Harris being freshmen. I thought it was a tremendous sign of respect. If you actually watch the tape and you watch these guys, those guys didn't play much in the first half, homie. They took them off the field for a reason. Terrell Lewis was a stand-up inside linebacker to start that game. Like they did it for a reason because they wanted to go to guys that they trusted and that knew the scheme that had been there for a while, and it didn't work. It didn't work at all. They actually had a long touchdown bust early in the first half that was strictly a bust and inside linebacker, but it's just interesting that Alabama tried to counter and do something different and it still didn't work. It wasn't successful. They tried to hide their weakness with other players with more experience and LSU still had success. But I mean, you know, no, Alabama didn't take Diggs or Surtain and put him in the slot. And, you know, I thought they adjusted and they got three stops in a row at one point in the game and got a chance to come back in it. But if we're going to be honest and listen, I'm just like everybody else out there, the Bama fatigue, and we've seen it for years and years and years, but I'm always going to be a guy that calls a spade. Tua wasn't healthy. I don't care what you say. You can sit here and argue with me till you're blue in the face. I'll give Tua 70% in that game. By the end, maybe he's 50. I mean, hobbling around like crazy, still making plays. You think about the mistake early. You don't play live games. You don't practice live, Kevin. And then you take off and run and try to scramble early in the game on that first possession and he fumbles by himself. And then the next possession, Bama's punter drops a ball. And then right before the half, Tua throws a pick that leads to seven more that gives them, you know, the huge cushion going into the half. And then Alabama still rallied. You know what? If I'm an LSU fan, I hope I don't play them again. I'm serious. I don't want to. I don't want Alabama in that four hole, and I have to play Alabama again. Because I can tell you, after watching that game, if they play 10 times, I can see Bama with a healthy Tua winning five of them. I mean, I could 100% see that. And that's something that, you know, people don't want to talk about it, but injuries are a part of the game, and the way the game happens and sometimes unfolds is what it is. But if I'm them, I don't want to see him again.
And I'm not going to argue, because he didn't look 100%. You couldn't see him slide. You could also see that played a role in how he was thinking out there on when he was trying to move a little bit in the pocket, but he wasn't like trying to move specifically or deliberately. He was trying to move because he had no choice. And that's the difference. And,
hey, can we talk about something else real quick?
Yeah.
Najee Harris. Good God.
Yeah. I told you
that
last week, right? I said that Najee was going to play a huge role in the game. And
both
it did.
Both 22s were big stars for their team, but not, you called it with Najee Harris, no doubt. He made himself some money. Yeah. That boy made some cheddar this weekend to watch that's a big adult. That's a huge running back at 6'2", you know, 230 something pounds. I mean, he's a big cat, and he was moving nimbly. He was catching back shoulder fades in the end zone. Like, he and Allaire were both, you know, two of the best players on the field next to Joe Burrow. But it's interesting. We talk about that, and you talk about Tua, and you go, you know, that was, I looked at Tua, Kevin, and I was like, Tua did not play well. He just did not look the part, play the part. He threw for 418 and had four touchdowns.
Isn't that crazy?
I mean, but uncharacteristically, you know, missed open guys. You could tell his timing was jacked up, and it wasn't because of LSU. It was, you know, just he hadn't had live bullets, and you could really, really tell the difference. But it was something else, man. You're talking about a guy that that just had surgery and didn't play great, that could still, you know, put up huge numbers. It was pretty impressive.
There was a couple of plays too that Judy dropped some passes where I'm like, oh man,
two touchdowns.
Yeah,
he dropped two touchdowns,
and that you know. What stood out to me was watching Bama in that first half, and then Judy dropping those balls where these are the plays Bama makes, and the opponent always, you know, screws up. It's the opponent who gets the pick, but has 12 men on the field, right? It's not Alabama, especially at home in a big game. Now, with all of that and Tua not being, you know, not being himself physically, and you know, news coming in today, the day of the podcast here on Wednesday, and Nick Saban saying that Tua is going to be a game time decision against Mississippi State. Would you play him this weekend?
Heck no.
You wouldn't?
Absolutely not. There's no chance in Hades I would play him. I would let him sit, and I would make sure I get him back to 100%. And then I want him to play Western Carolina and Auburn the last two games. But I want him to play Western Carolina because I need to get him some game reps. You know, I need to, so it doesn't happen again with LSU where he's not crisp and you're going to go against a really great defense at the end of the year with Auburn. But I gotta shut him down because there's no way he's close to 100%. And here's the thing, man. It's such a grind for athletes. I'm just telling you, when you rehab, Kevin, it's a grind. It's mentally exhausting. It is literally, he has been in treatment 24/7, Kevin, at the house. In his room, he's in treatment. He's in treatment at the facility at 5 a.m. every morning. He's in treatment after practice when practice is over. You know, like it's an exhausting process. And I hope for his sake that they shut him down a little bit. They let him do his rehab. They get him back stronger, get him in the weight room a little bit. And, I don't see the point. Mac Jones is easily good enough to beat Mississippi State. He just is. And then you start getting to it, right? That's what I would do.
All right, we'll see how this plays out. Before we move on to a little bit about Minnesota, is Joe Burrow the number one quarterback prospect in your mind entering the draft?
Yeah, I think I would put him there because here's the thing that I have with Tua. First of all, Herbert, no, I don't put anybody else in this category, Eason, Fromm, whoever else you want to talk about. To me, it's Tua and Burrow in a category of their own. His dependability, his durability is a question mark. He's not a big guy. And now you've started to see the injuries just, you know, both ankles have been operated on in college. And he's not a big guy and takes a bunch of hits. And when he takes hits, bad things seem to happen. So I know what I'm getting from Joe Burrow. He's not as physically gifted as Tua, but man, oh man, he showed you he can run a different type of offense. I think he showed you he can throw, make NFL throws this season. His deep ball has been on point. His scrambling ability to buy time has been really, really good. So I think I would lean Burrow because of those things.
I'm with you. Man, he has the temperament, man.
he don't care.
He's got that coolness about him where you're like, okay, you're going to lead a team. And obviously it's a different level on Sundays, but when you could see it on Saturdays on the road in the SEC at Tuscaloosa, it speaks volumes. All right. Now, speaking of volumes, man, Minnesota and that offense, I was really impressed. Tanner Morgan was efficient. What more can you tell us about the unit? When I say efficient, when you look at the numbers.
Efficient.
No, when I say that, I'm saying when you look at the numbers, he does not make mistakes. High completion percentage, those
how
two
about
wide
he was
receivers.
A baller?
Yeah, he was.
This? Well, don't tell me efficient. He wasn't a game manager. Homeboy was 18 for 20 for 340 and three touchdowns and no INTs. Don't make him sound like he was a system quarterback.
No, I'm not saying that. Now you were just taking, you're making
I'm telling
use
you
of
how
that
you
specific
said it.
Word.
That's the way you said it, bro. Efficient.
He was efficient. he was good.
No. I didn't mean it that way. Okay. He was just, I'm impressed by, he doesn't need to throw the ball 25 to 30 times in this offense. He throws the ball 20 to 21, 22 times. And the high completion percentage, he finds ways to move the ball down the field without excess, right? And that to me is efficiency. He's efficient because boom, 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 boom. He completes a high percentage of his passes before you twist my commentary.
Super.
Now let's take a look at the tape. Tell us what you see.
He's a great game manager. He's 18 to 21, like we said, for 340. And, the offensive design, by the way, a lot of those guys were wide open and they did a great job with their route concepts. By the way, we've been talking about it for weeks and about Penn State's deficiencies in the back end. Now you saw them. Their front seven, I told you, it's as good as anybody's in the nation. But if you can get time to throw, you're playing freshmen back there. A lot of freshmen and you're playing a lot of inexperience and a lot of guys that they're not going to be able to cover forever. And when you see Bateman go off for 203 yards and 30 yards a catch and Johnson went off for over 100 yards and, they made some contested catches, but the majority of those catches were big time plays that were open and they were open and Morgan hit them. And, it's an offense that ran the football enough. It didn't run the football a lot or super great, but they ran it efficiently enough to be able to play action and, but just the decision making and the way they designed their concepts in the passing game to get guys open and stuff, they have a really good idea of who they are, of what they are, and just a lot of fun to watch, man. A lot of fun to watch a team that should be overmatched big time up front, but the way they can find ways to protect, the way they can find ways to, manufacture offense, it's really, really good, really smart. Really sound, game managing type stuff, man. Just game manager. That's what they are. That's just, they're doing it, brother.
You're such a jerk.
Yes, I am. I'm really good at it. By the way, one more thing about them.
Yeah.
Forget their offense. Antoine Winfield Jr. is an animal.
Oh, yeah.
And he's been doing it all year long. And when he's playing center field, mm-hmm. and you should know Antoine Winfield, who played at Ohio State, played in the league for a long time, but this is his son. And obviously when he plays center field, don't throw the ball near him. Seven picks this season. I mean, he has been he plays the ball in the air so dang well. It's ridiculous. And he can cover the whole field. I mean, it's really fun and impressive to watch. And he's not just good like for a Minnesota guy. He's one of the best safeties in the country, period.
Man, you sit there and you see, his dad, obviously a star with the Buckeyes. Good player in the NFL too. And you sit there and you're like, how is he still in the same conference, but he's not playing, for Ohio State? That, cause he stands out specifically on that defense. And it's a credit to PJ Fleck, man, because that team is so well coached on both sides.
Yes, they are. Elite.
I gotta give them so much credit, but now we'll get to that pick next on Friday on our next podcast because now they gotta go to Kinnick and deal with that environment. And
Iowa's the bane of your existence.
3-point dogs.
Are we gonna talk about your picks later?
God, man, we'll do that on Friday, man.
I've got another notch in the belt. I've got no time here
for this conversation. Yeah. Who's the dude of the week for you, buddy?
Andrew Thomas, left tackle, University of Georgia, number 71, takes almost every snap. The best lineman I've seen in college football. Pass, run, I mean, he moves people. He gets up. He literally will pancake somebody and just kind of get up and walk back to the huddle. But just the most dominant player on Georgia and the most dominant offensive lineman week in, week out. Just, you can tell. I guarantee you he'll be a top 10 pick in the NFL this next year, and he'll be the first offensive lineman taken. But if you're going to watch Auburn this week and you want to pick a dude of the week and stuff, you want to see that big physical defensive line versus that big physical offensive line of Georgia. And I'm going to be watching Andrew Thomas because he's the guy that makes it go.
Looking forward to it, especially against Auburn in that front four and how he handles things. I reminded you guys, if you have a question you want to hear on the podcast for Herbie or Pollock, tweet using the hashtag CFBpod. You ready for some of our listeners? They've got some questions for you.
Bring it, bro.
All right, here's a pretty good one. You're stranded on a desert island for a year. Jeez. And you have to survive on only three things. What are they?
Okay. Desert island, and I only get three things.
Yeah. You're Tom Hanks, Castaway, buddy.
Okay.
So you got three things.
I want clothes.
I imagine this may be in the concept of food or sustenance. So
clothes. I already have clothes.
Yeah. You have clothes.
Okay. Do I have blankets? Because I would love a blanket. A blanket would be great to sleep in.
Only you would screw up this question.
Blanket / sleeping bag.
Okay.
Okay. How about this? How about a lighter? Some form of, is that better? Is that what you want more?
Yeah, well, clearly, you know, the
matches, fire.
Tom Hanks's character took a long time to get that fire going. So yeah, okay, we'll go with a lighter.
All right. I did one, so you do one now.
Oh, we're going back and forth?
Yeah.
You're part serious. Of
this too, bro.
I'm with you. My first thing would be a lighter too. So yeah, we've got those first two things.
Can I ask you a question? You seem like the Boy Scout type. Were you a Boy Scout?
Are you kidding me? No.
No.
And that's not a knock on the Boy Scouts, but where would you come to that conclusion?
That's not a knock on the Boy Scouts.
Like, where would you kind of like, you so, seem like the guy. Like, what the heck does that mean?
I'm going to leave that there for a second. Could you start a fire by yourself? Like,
come on, man.
Could you? I'm asking you a question, bro.
Yeah, I can start a fire, but I have fireplaces. I can start a fire. Come on.
So you could create fire on your own.
What? Are you rubbing? You mean rubbing sticks?
Yes. Well, you can create a fire.
No, clearly you can't either because you want a lighter the same way I want a lighter on,
correct,
on an island.
I'm not saying I can. I'm just saying you might be more handy than me. I am not a manly man. I don't do hunting. I don't do tools.
I'm not doing hunting unless it's necessary, and that would be me being on an island. But no, okay. No.
All right, so what else are you getting? I would need some form of weapon to get my food.
Yeah. I would have to craft a weapon or find a way to get a fishing rod because then, I'm going fishing. I'm going somewhere out there in the water or you're using a spear to bring in the fish, right?
That would be amazing.
Right.
Can I get a workout room? Does that work?
Oh my God.
Can I get a weight room?
Yes.
No?
Just pick up a bunch of rocks. That's your workout, all right? And then throw them above your head at an animal. All right. Your third thing. All right. What are you taking? The third thing.
Oh, I'm not very good at this stuff.
It's clear because you're dumping it on me and you're talking about having blankets on an island. Come on. Give me a third thing.
I'm sorry. Okay. Shelter. Some form of shelter over my head. Like a, some form of a roof, a house. Give me a house. I'm stranded in a house. I'm good with a house. Okay. Yeah. How's that?
Next thing you get, like 3A, I want a heater. Like, well, come on.
A heater would be good too. Would I? No, if I'm on an island, though, it's deserted. If it's a tropical island, I'm good, bro. I don't need a heater.
Okay. Air conditioner. You're asking for a house on an island.
Can I take my wool socks?
Oh, gosh. Let's just move on to the next question.
That's an important part of my outfit, by the way. Every day I wear wool socks.
My feet
get freezing. I wear wool socks all the time.
You live in Georgia.
Yeah, right now I have at least one pair of wool socks on.
Wait. You live in the South and you wear wool socks?
Yeah, but I went to Connecticut yesterday, so I'm still cold.
And no one's feeling sorry for you for your one-day trip. But, like, you're wearing
I feel sorry for me to have to go to your city.
And it is so cold. 22,
thank God I'm back, bro.
22
thank
degrees
God
and the wind chill here. And
all right, what's our next question?
Yeah, exactly. With David's strict diet and non-garbage philosophy for his personal temple, does he ever enjoy an adult beverage?
No. Never.
Have you ever?
When I was in like eighth grade or ninth grade, something like that, long, long time ago with some buddies once.
That was it? No. Just once?
Yeah.
And you didn't like the taste. You just didn't like not being in control.
Both don't fit with my personality because I'm already crazy enough, but I don't like to put anything in my body, first of all, that's not good for my body. Yep. And that definitely accomplishes that. And then I definitely want to be in control of myself and not something else being in control of me. So it's twofold, but no alcoholic beverages will go in this temple.
All right. So if we're on the island, just send all the drinks to me because I'm going to need it if I'm on that island.
Especially with me.
Don't send it to Pollock.
You're going
to
need it.
Don't send it to Pollock.
I'm sending you fishing, bro. You go get us some food. I'll stay in the house. Yeah.
After I'm done this six pack. All right, good stuff, Paul. We got more questions coming your way, of course, on Friday, and then we go over our picks, and I'm really not looking forward to it.
Well, it's okay, man. Everybody goes through down spurts for 14 weeks like you have. That's okay. No big deal. It's all right.
And we'll be back in a minute with Heather Dinich, who's always on the go. She joins us from Bradley Airport in Hartford with a ton of insight on the latest playoff rankings, and we play a handful of scenarios for the top teams. But first, a word from Allstate and AT&T. Because mayhem on Saturdays in the fall is inevitable. Mayhem happens on the field, off the field, and in the polls. Mayhem lives on the wind, in the rain, on the foot of an errant kick, and during a trap game. You'll find mayhem in the parking lot, during tailgates, charcoal that's not totally out, an errant football through a window, a flat tire, a lost side view mirror, etc. You get the point. Allstate protects you from mayhem in the parking lot and outside it, at home and away. You can't stop mayhem from happening, but you can get better protected from it with Allstate. The potential for mayhem during the playoff race is rampant. Underdogs, trap games, unexpected weather, etc., etc., etc. Get better protected from mayhem with Allstate. Contact your local Allstate agent today.
Yeah, college football is great unless, of course, it's just okay. Like when students decide to paint their chest with different letters to spell some word, and then they stand together to get on TV, but they're spelling the word wrong, or they lined up in the wrong order. Sure, not everybody's an English major, and I get it. We can't all win the national spelling bee. But come on, people. You should know how to spell Wildcats or Bulldogs. The purpose isn't to have a word jumble in the student section to keep your mind sharp or something. Just okay is not okay, whether it's college football fans or your wireless network. You want to watch the best college football just like you want to go with AT&T, America's best network. Don't settle for typos on people's chests, and don't settle for anything less than the best wireless network. Get the best college football and get AT&T. Best network based on GWS One Score, September 2019.
You know, when the rankings were released on Tuesday night, I was already prepping for our conversation with Heather, college football insider Heather Dinich, joining us on the College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. And it's a new Wednesday, and it's a new airport for Heather as she joins us during her travels, which is always a great thing that she has time to do that. And Heather, what surprised you before boarding? What surprised you the most from last night?
Well, I think it's the fact that they rewarded Georgia's good wins more than the loss to South Carolina hurt them. I think that was the big lesson learned. I thought after Alabama lost to LSU that they were in big trouble. But I still thought that they would be the committee's highest ranked one loss team. But when they sat there at number 5 on Tuesday night, I looked at that and I thought, wow, it really is a chance for the Pac-12 to jump the tide. And for the first time in the era of the college football playoff, I think we're seeing the most legitimate chance that Alabama could really be left out of this thing.
What does Bama have to root for? I said it last night. They have to root for chaos in the top 4. What do you think?
I agree with you. I think that it would help them if Utah won the Pac-12 or if the Pac-12 had a 2-loss conference champion. But I also think that they're looking up at 2 teams in their own league that need to create a little bit of chaos. You know, one thing that I was thinking about today is what happens if Auburn beats both Georgia and Alabama and Georgia wins the SEC.
Uh-oh.
Auburn would have a win against the SEC champs, and two wins against top five teams. Mm-hmm. What do you do then? Then Alabama is really in trouble.
Yeah, and somewhere Gus is smiling.
Yeah. So there are still a lot of things that can play out, but beyond the Big 12 and Pac-12 kind of hanging around there, Alabama, I think, more so has to be concerned with the possibility of being snubbed by Georgia and LSU right now.
You brought up the Big 12, and you saw Baylor drop one spot, and then we saw Oklahoma drop a spot. How much does the committee respect this conference right now?
It's in it's in the worst possible position that it can be in. And you mentioned them dropping in spite of wins. Both of those wins were close games. I saw the end of TCU Baylor as well as Oklahoma and Iowa State. They were both fortunate to win those games. But Selection Committee Chair Rob Mullins also pointed out specifically on Tuesday night's teleconference when asked about it that Oklahoma's defense has taken steps back. They've noticed that. The Sooners have regressed defensively. You know, we were all piling on the praise for Alex Grinch at the start of the season, and that hasn't been the case over the past couple of weeks, and the committee has noticed it. But also, as you look down the stretch, they don't have as many opportunities against ranked opponents as a Minnesota does. You know, Minnesota's got chances coming up here against Iowa. They have a Northwestern sandwich between the game against Wisconsin, but Minnesota can really make far more of a statement to the selection committee resume-wise than either Baylor or Oklahoma.
And I know we do a lot of discussion here, and we started it off with Alabama. Like, everybody considers the conference that can get two teams in as the SEC, but could we see a scenario where Minnesota, you know, wins the rest of their games and then plays Ohio State close in the Big Ten Championship? Could we see a scenario where Minnesota makes it along with Ohio State if we have some other chaos?
We could if we have some other chaos, but I also considered that a little bit deeper today as well. And I think Minnesota's best chance would be to lose to Penn State in the Big Ten Championship game, because then they could say, hey, our only loss is to the Big Ten champs. Oh, and by the way, we beat them.
Wow.
You can't, right? You can't say that against Ohio State. And look, if Penn State runs the table, wins in Columbus, upsets Minnesota, we're talking about the Nittany Lions having a top four resume very easily right there. And then for Minnesota to be able to say, well, guess what? We beat the Big Ten champs. That's a pretty big deal.
Are you playing the same scenario, too, though, for Ohio State that Alabama has, right? Where they'll question who they played. And if they were to lose the way Alabama lost to LSU, if they were to lose to Penn State the same way at home, you know, by like 5 points, and, you know, they try to come back in the second half, but then they don't get the chance to play in the conference game, the conference championship game, like in Alabama, could you make the same argument with Ohio State potentially getting in?
You could, but again, both of those teams would then be held to a different standard in that selection committee meeting room, not having the chance to play for their conference championship game. And would Ohio State down the stretch have enough opportunities to impress the committee with saying they're, quote, unequivocally one of four best teams, and much similar to Alabama? I would say probably not. But unlike Alabama, Ohio State is sitting there in the top four right now. And they have been ranked ahead of Alabama in each of the first two rankings. Would they still be, you know, in that range with a loss to Penn State? How far would they fall? That would help answer that question. But the teams that don't win conference titles just face such a tougher burden to get in. Remember, 17 of 20 playoff participants have been conference champs.
Mm-hmm. And that plays a role here when we discuss the Pac-12. So, again, Utah is rooting for Oregon. Oregon is rooting for Utah all the way through here. And let's just play the first scenario out. Oregon beats Utah. They both come into the conference championship with one loss. And then Oregon's only blemish is that Auburn game. And if Alabama beats Auburn, and let's just say Alabama decides we need to make a statement here because down the road we're going to probably match up against Oregon, and we beat Auburn by 20 points. Does that play a scenario out where you look at things and who played who? Because in the end, you know, Alabama beat Auburn, Auburn beat Oregon, but the one thing Oregon has is a top 10 win.
Right. You're exactly right. And that would be better than anything Alabama would have on its resume at that point. But again, I go back to our earlier discussion about LSU and Georgia, because that impacts whether or not Alabama's even in the conversation for that fourth spot with Oregon. So Oregon could be fighting against a second or third SEC team, depending on how that whole situation plays out. Because if Georgia has one loss and wins the SEC, LSU has one loss, Alabama has one loss, mm-hmm. then you get into that debate. But to your point about Auburn, it's one piece of the puzzle. I feel like Selection Committee Chair Rob Mullins when I say that, but it's true, because there are those tiebreakers and common opponents is one of them, but so is strength of schedule, and Alabama would not be able to check that box, and so is conference championships. Mm-hmm. Again, Alabama couldn't check that box. But we haven't seen any other Pac-12 teams ranked by the selection committee either. So how good is Oregon or Utah's resume? At least Oregon was in, had a fighting chance against Auburn. You look at Utah, and we're talking about BYU, Northern Illinois, Idaho State, and a loss to USC. Yikes.
Mm-hmm. There's, again, it's very fluid, and mm-hmm. just a week ago, people were losing their minds about, you know, where's Penn State ranked and why are they there and where's Clemson? And then suddenly, you know, you have two losses in the top four. So things can change week by week. I'll play one more scenario out before we let you go. If Baylor were to beat Oklahoma this weekend and down the road, Baylor will face Oklahoma again in the Big 12 championship game, can you see Baylor making the jump to get in?
Not if... If Baylor beats Oklahoma and then loses to Oklahoma in the Big 12 title game, no. I would be shocked if a one-loss Baylor got in. Undefeated Baylor, it's not necessarily all that different of a conversation, to be perfectly honest. Mm-hmm. And I say that not because of any of my personal opinions about Baylor, but because of where they've been ranked by the selection committee. They are clearly not getting any respect in that room, and some of it is because of strength of schedule. They played Stephen F. Austin, UTSA, and Rice. They needed double overtime to beat Texas Tech and TCU. It's a combination of the schedule strength, and Baylor just isn't that good.
Cannot wait what's going to play out this weekend. Heather, thank you so much. We really enjoy having you on Wednesday, the day after, for the React, and looking forward to having you next week. We'll be back in a minute with Ivan Maizel with his thoughts on Minnesota's biggest challenge in front of them and why Saturday could be more than just a loss for Alabama. But first, a word from Dr. Pepper.
Make sure to tune in to my new favorite TV show, Fansville, presented by Dr. Pepper, returning every Saturday throughout the college football season during the commercials. Fansville is the only show that stars Dr. Pepper, puts the spotlight on fans, and perfectly captures the emotional roller coaster that is the college football season. Critics are saying it's good, fantastic, is anyone else thirsty, and literally the best thing since Diet Dr. Pepper and Dr. Pepper Cherry. In Fansville, Dr. Pepper delivers a tour de force performance alongside legendary college football co-stars Brian the Boz Bosworth and Eddie George. Experience the pain, the passion, and the deliciousness of college football fandom this fall on Fansville, presented by Dr. Pepper. So pull over, veer right, slant left, do what you gotta do to get to your local store and pick up some refreshing ice cold Dr. Pepper, the official drink of Fansville. And hey, while you're at it, don't be afraid to go for two.
All right, as he does every single Wednesday, great to have ESPN senior writer Ivan Maizel joining us here on the College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. First impressions of the second rankings last night, Ivan?
Yeah, no great surprise that LSU moved up ahead of Ohio State, because, you know, you beat number three on the road. Of course, you're going to move up. I thought Ohio State, you know, not much else you could ask them to do than the way they beat Maryland. Little surprised that Minnesota, even though they made what is it, the largest 1 week jump, you know, going from 17th to 8th, I thought they should have been higher.
Yeah.
But, And I wasn't really surprised at Georgia being ahead of Alabama at all. Georgia at four and Alabama at five. I was surprised at the speculation that Alabama would fall only to four. I think goes back to Alabama's strength of schedule, vis-a-vis Georgia. Georgia has that win against Notre Dame and big wins, I think, way more than who you lost to.
We'll get to Alabama in a second, especially the aftermath on Saturday. But you brought up Minnesota. That ranking there, I mean, they jump up nine spots, but where would you put them then? If you look at, the 2 1-loss teams in the Pac-12, and then you look at the 2 SEC teams with one loss, and where would you have put them coming off that win?
I thought they should be ahead of Utah. I mean, you could convince me they shouldn't be ahead of Oregon, but I would have been fine had they been sixth. I think there's probably a gap from an Alabama to Minnesota, Oregon, Utah, which will close up if those teams keep winning. But I would put Minnesota at least seventh, possibly sixth.
And I think the biggest challenge for PJ Fleck will be, not so much Penn State coming to your place where you don't need to, to remind anybody. It's just, hey, let's get focused for on the road in Kinnick against Iowa. And let's not forget a couple years ago what Ohio State went through, right? Ohio State beats Penn State, right? In a huge game. And then they go on the road and the Hawkeyes just blast them in front of a national audience.
Yeah. And I was there the night they beat Michigan by a point, one of the great tense taught, classic Big Ten games I've ever seen. I think what was that 3 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago. So it's a tough place to play. And the style of football that Iowa plays, it's not flashy. It's just very fundamentally sound and you have to focus. And this is a real test of the Gophers' maturity after such a momentous win, emotional win over Penn State, coming the way it did. Nobody thought they could do it, saving it at the last moment. The delirium that engulfed the stadium after the game. And now you got to turn around and you got to work hard. And that's a lot for a young team to do.
And Tanner Morgan's been fantastic, especially when you talk about his efficiency, right? Those wide receivers are often overlooked. I think they grab the national attention on how well they play, and they got a talented backfield. The one thing that has really impressed me with PJ Fleck too is this team is well coached. I mean, all three phases, they're disciplined and they play smart football. Now people are going to bring up how they played in the first three games, but they were trying to figure things out. And since then, they've been outstanding.
They really have. And I think you hit on a key point. They seem to have found themselves after groping around for the first part of the month. And that's what well coached teams do. They get better. Framing it in those terms, Kevin, makes me, a little more sanguine about their chances Saturday. I mean, I'm skeptical that they can go into Iowa City and win, but, if you put it that way and you look at the totality of what they've done this year and the way they have constantly gotten better and that they have met these challenges as they have arisen and that they have won a lot of close games, sometimes what you see is a minus, you can spin it around and maybe they didn't have any business being in a close game against all those, the FCS teams and the group of five teams, but they won them. So at least we know, they can finish, and that I think will probably come into play, in Iowa City and what will probably be it's certainly the atmosphere will be great. It'll be dark. I'm sure it'll be cold. I'm sure they're going to hit hard. That's going to be a fun game.
Yeah, it feels like a 20-17 game, a classic Iowa, and that I think benefits Kirk Ferentz if it is 20-17 or something like that, where you're slowing down Minnesota's offense. And you mentioned the environment in Kinnick, and Iowa City will be great. You were in Tuscaloosa on Saturday. You watched the LSU Alabama game. That environment on TV jumped out. The score 46-41. But reading your Monday column, you brought up the mistakes from Bama in the first half. They look sloppy. They look like things that other teams would commit as they would wilt against that aura of Bama at home. And it felt like, as I was reading the column, this was more than just one loss. Could you expand on that, on the vibe that you got from not just so much Alabama, but also what you saw from LSU?
The point I had in writing the column, which was basically, is that it's always hard to recognize in real time when a dynastic team is, you know, losing its edge. And the reason that stuck in my head Saturday is I started thinking about Florida State, 20 years ago, and they won the national championship in 99. They lose the champion, they lose the BCS final to Oklahoma in 2000, and they just sort of gradually lost it from that point forward. And we didn't really recognize it at the time. And Miami, ascended to the top after Florida State. And they, when they lost to Ohio State in double overtime, it never occurred to anybody that that was it, that that was the peak. USC, Vince Young runs to the pylon with 19 seconds left in 2005. We all thought USC would be back, and I did an entire down and distance podcast about that. So that, I have this idea in my head of it, it's hard to know when the dynasty ends, except when you look back. And with that in mind, Alabama's played two teams that we see as their equal since January, and Clemson blew them out for four quarters, and LSU blew them out for two. There are plenty of reasons why. There are a lot of injuries. They didn't have a healthy starting quarterback. The defense is young, but they were just making uncharacteristic mistakes for a Saban team on Saturday, and it was a 5-point game, and they fought hard and came back in the second half, but they never had the ball with a chance to win the game. All credit to LSU, doing that on the road, coming out immediately and seizing control of the game. So that it's more like I asked the question and I don't know the answer, but I think you have to ask the question, are we at the point now where Alabama has taken a step back?
There's some great lines in the piece, and I'm paraphrasing here, where you say the more you win, the more winning isn't enough. It becomes mere relief that you didn't lose. And some of the coaches, some of the great coaches through, the many decades of college football have experienced that. You described the pressure in that building to win was enormous, because you were there a couple of weeks ago. That feeling of pressure, was it comparable to other times that you were in that place? How would you kind of use that as a comparison?
Well, I've had a couple of people say to me in that building, we're not allowed to lose. We're not allowed to stumble. And my column is a great example of that. It could be they just had a bad day and that's it. And I promise you, judging from the Twitter responses, that's what the entire Alabama fan base thinks. And they could be right. I could be jumping the gun here, but I think, they feel it there, and the fact that, Nick has done what he has done is so unlike the way every other coach and every other dynasty has done it. He's had an incredible turnover, not just of players, but of staff. But he's the one constant, and his program, is the one constant. And he talked about it again Saturday after the game. Sometimes we focus on outcome, and you can't do that. You have to focus on the process to get to the outcome. So I had to chuckle when I saw his comments from the press conference Monday, you know, that he wasn't going to talk about the playoff. You know, they're going to focus on Mississippi State. You know, we're not worried about the outcome. We're worried about what we have to do next. And, you know, that's classic Nick, and it's enabled them to do things that no program has done really ever. To be as successful as they've been as consistently for this period of time.
Yeah, and you mentioned the turnover of coaches, and again, the turnover of players too. That defense is so young, also dealing with all the injuries that they've gone through. Tua can't play defense. You know, he did everything he could offensively, but he can't play defense in that second.
And he wasn't 100%.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And that was apparent, especially on a couple rollouts where you're like, he can't move. He's trying to, but he's aware of the injury. And when you're aware of the injury and you can't just play instinctively, that plays a role in your decision making. On the other side, everywhere you're turning right now, you're seeing Ed Orgeron on First Take, on Get Up. I love it. And you know, I actually think he deserves it. But at the same time, we could potentially down the road see these two teams again. And that is a lot of scenarios playing out in a 1-4 matchup, right? If things were to go the way they could go to favor Alabama at the top and we have some chaos around, it feels like, now, their next three games, the teams that they're going to play, they're going to catch the break because they went through the toughest part, right? And the next three games, I think those three teams have a total of 5 wins. But the idea of Joe Burrow not – and Herbie talked about this a little bit with us – not taking his foot off the gas on every single possession. That's what stands out to me with LSU. Like, they will not take a play off. And that's the difference between this team and teams we have seen in the past.
Sure. And, you know, they're not taking their pedal off the gas of a very good machine. You know, they've last few years on offense, they've been like a, you know, 74 Rambler. this offense is good. And that's a lot of that credit goes to Joe Burrow and to the running back and of course to Joe Brady, you know, who's been the brains behind the deal. And I think to your point about there possibly there being a rematch and LSU having to, they're definitely going to play Alabama next year and all the comments and the smack talk by LSU, you know, that's going to come up. You know, Alabama will be thinking about that the next time they play LSU, whenever that is. And you can argue that LSU should have acted like they'd been there before, but they hadn't been there before.
Especially Eddie O.
It's been 8 years.
Versus Saban, yes.
Yeah.
I love it. And it just shows his reaction. It shows why the players love it, why the program is always behind him. When you look at the DNA of LSU, it's the players, and they are so loyal to Orgeron. But I've talked to multiple guys that have played with Orgeron that have been recruited by Orgeron through the years, and they all love him. And that's the one common theme, because he loves you. You love him back because you know he's from a good place. And we saw that on the field. And, you know, I feel, I'm glad that Orgeron said what he said inside that locker room. I feel bad that it got released because it's supposed to stay inside the locker room, and he's allowed to be himself, right?
Sure. And you know what, Kevin, that's a really important point about the love that those players feel from him. Because we all think that that's what the relationship between coaches and players should be, but it's not always like that. It's somebody phrased it to me the other day as seeing the players as more than X's and O's on a piece of paper. And I think there are some coaches who don't make that emotional connection to their players. And the ones that do, a lot of times, are the successful ones.
Yes, they are. And you can see it effectively work on certain programs. A guy like Dabo stands out as well individually, how they have relationships. And it's most important now than ever before, considering when you're recruiting a player, because if you're recruiting a player at that level who's a 5-star, what's the personalization response, and how are you making sure you are unique from others? Because many of these programs across the board can look the same. How do you separate yourself? And a guy like Ed Orgeron could do that. And now an offense can do that where they have a passing attack. Ivan, good stuff, man. Really appreciate the insight you shared with us in Tuscaloosa, and looking forward to the weekend.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin.
Appreciate it, Ivan, Heather, and Pollock for joining us here on the podcast this Wednesday. Also want to thank our sponsors, Allstate, AT&T, and Dr. Pepper. Excellent work from our producer, Taylor Schwenk, a Maryland grad who's already on to college hoops. Sorry. It was a good run those first 2 weeks of the season. If you enjoy this podcast and you want more, all you have to do is subscribe to the College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Check out our brand new podcast, ESPN Daily, hosted by Mina Kimes, Monday through Friday. She takes a look at the most interesting stories at ESPN in just 20 minutes. Listen and subscribe now to ESPN Daily, wherever you find your podcast. I love doing it every single day. Mina, she brings the best stuff out. By the way, if you have a question and you want to hear it on the podcast with Herbie, Pollock, myself, or any of our guests, tweet using the hashtag CFBPod, and the best ones will make it to one of our podcasts. Cannot wait for Friday. Pollock's going to make his picks. A lot of trash talk, I'm sure, is going to be coming my direction. But we're also going to have the Bear. Chris Felica is going to join us to talk about his experience on game day and get his thoughts on the season. He's already played a handful of scenarios outside of this coming weekend for the committee. And I want to talk about the nickname and his climb to the top on game day. Enjoy the rest of the week. We'll talk to you on Friday.